right, y'all, let's do this. What?
Now it's time to practice two rescuer infant CPR. When you perform two rescuer CPR, the person doing compressions should use the two thumb encircling hands technique. Here are the steps. Place both thumbs side by side in the center of the infant's chest on the lower half of the sternum. There should be no pressure placed on the tip of the sternum, and your thumbs may overlap in very small infants. Then encircle the infant's chest and support the infant's back with the fingers of both hands. In this position, use both thumbs to depress the sternum at least one third the depth of the infant's chest, which equates to approximately 1.5 inches or 4 centimeters. Let's take note of a key difference between one and two rescuer infant CPR. Instead of a 30-to-2 ratio in a one rescuer situation, you'll use the ratio of 15 compressions to 2 breaths.
Wait, I already watched this video. Why? Minna 大丈夫? Can you all hear me? Yes. No, I don't know, maybe so. I don't know what I'm doing. Oh? Amazing.
Well, I have my pediatric advanced life support course thing tomorrow. And usually the course is 8 hours long. But they recently cut the course down to 4 hours, but you have to watch like 60 videos. You have to watch like 4 hours worth of videos before you go.
I know, Saiken. Saiken knows the pain. He knows the pain.
Okay. Anyways, welcome to Pediatric Advanced Life Support. I hope you learned something. I'm literally going to mull over this for the next, I don't know, 2 hours or so. And let's answer some questions. Okay.
What is the compression to breath ratio for one and two rescuer CPR for children and infants? Choose the correct option and select submit. Okay, so this one's easy. One rescuer is 30-to-2 and two rescuers is 15-to-2. Yeah. If you guys have ever done advanced life support or anything like that, you know 30-to-2 is the adult rate. So correcto. Oh, now we're gonna listen to some pediatric choking.
Products are shown for demonstration purposes only. The AHA does not endorse or recommend any specific manufacturer or product. In order to show skills clearly, the healthcare providers in this video do not always use recommended personal protective equipment,
so
such as gloves. To help improve your assessment skills, the American Heart Association training series includes videos of actual children with medical problems.
Okay,
of course, at no time was medical care delayed for the purpose of obtaining this video. All children...
We use free chat. Oh, no, but I'm using my wrong account, though. Chotto mate. Okay. I go to free chat. Hola. Can you hear the vids? I'm gonna pop this out. I don't want to do this. I'm still on lesson 3 and there are 11 fucking lessons.
Received timely and appropriate medical care and parents provided consent before recording.
Senna, welcome.
When food or other items block a person's airway, choking occurs. In severe airway obstructions, the victim usually will have signs of poor air exchange and breathing difficulty,
Milky,
such as a silent cough.
Milky, I was watching the video earlier in times 2 speed, but now I'm turning it down to 1.25 because universal choking sign. I didn't want you guys to not be able to understand what's going on. But I usually listen to everything in two times speed. Yeah.
To perform this maneuver, stand or kneel behind the child and place your arms around his or her waist. With one hand, locate the navel. Then make a fist with the other hand and place the thumb side of your fist against the victim's abdomen, just above the navel and below the breastbone. Grab your fist with your other hand and press your fist into the victim's abdomen with a quick, forceful upward thrust. Repeat thrust
until
the object is expelled from the airway
for this.
Or the victim becomes unresponsive.
I'm going to put it to point.
If your attempts to relieve choking in the child are unsuccessful and the child becomes unresponsive, send someone to activate the emergency response system.
You know what?
Lower the victim to the ground and
begin. I'm going to listen to it in times 2 speed. I don't have time for this, guys.
Each time you open the airway to give rest, look for the obstructing object.
It doesn't let me go on to the next video unless I finish the whole video. So I can't. I have to watch the whole video. Back in the airway. And I already know all of this.
A fairly common emergency among infants. The steps to relieve choking in an infant are quite different than those for older children. If you find an infant choking and he or she is responsive, first sit or kneel with the infant in your lap. Then hold the infant face down and resting on your forearm with the head slightly lower than the chest. Support the head and jaw with your hand.
You literally
avoid
slap the baby on its back.
Then
when
rest
it
your forearm
chokes
on your thigh to provide support. Deliver up to 5 back slaps forcefully
between
the infant's shoulder blades using the heel of your hand. Deliver each slap with sufficient force to attempt to remove the foreign body. Then place your free hand on the infant's back, supporting the head
then
with the palm of your
hand.
Then
turn the baby around
the infant between your two forearms and turn the infant over while carefully supporting the head.
Chest compression.
Keep the infant's head lower than the chest and deliver up to 5 quick downward chest thrusts in the same location that you performed
the pressure. 5 back slaps, 5 downward chest thrusts.
Do this at the rate of about 1 per second. Then repeat the sequence of 5 back slaps and 5 chest thrusts until the object is removed.
You know, usually during the house class, you're supposed to watch the video and then actually do the demonstration after.
Once you can see the object, carefully try to remove it. Never perform a blind finger sweep.
Yeah,
you only want to see an object if
I'm just practicing on
after about 2 minutes
on a stuffed animal CPR, right now.
Emergency response system. We'll pause here to allow you to get in position to practice with the infant mannequins.
Like, I have a little, like, a stuffed toy that I'm pretending to do CPR on with this. It actually helps, you know, if you can actually learn how to do it.
Practice shop for demonstration purposes only. The AHA does not endorse or recommend any specific manufacturer or product. In order to show skills clearly, the healthcare providers in this video do not always use recommended personal protection.
I really hate how they have to do this stupid, like, disclaimer before every single video.
For the purpose of obtaining this video, all children receive timely and appropriate medical care.
Anyway, I'm downing my coffee right now.
Welcome to the pediatric systematic assessment video. In this video, we will focus on evaluating your patient, identifying the presenting problem, and providing appropriate interventions. Once you perform the interventions, you'll repeat the process by reevaluating the patient and identifying whether the problem has resolved or worsened. Then you'll apply additional interventions as appropriate. Because a child's condition can change rapidly, you'll need to repeat the evaluate, identify, intervene sequence, or EII. Frequently
infectious yawning. OMG.
The first step in systematic approach is the initial assessment. It's what you first see and hear when you immediately encounter the child before you touch the child. You'll quickly observe the child's appearance, breathing, and circulation. This will determine
ABCs.
The next action. The pediatric assessment triangle, or PAT,
what?
Is a memory aid to help you recall the components of the initial across-the-room assessment.
First thing observed is the child's appearance. This includes his level of consciousness and ability to
interesting.
Memorize.
Interesting. I've never heard this.
Shout for help and activate the response system.
Pediatric
rescue breathing or CPR needed.
Something something.
The next part of the pediatric
assessment
triangle is evaluation
triangle.
Of work breathing. Is there an increase or decrease in rate or effort? Is it normal? Or are there audible respiratory sounds? After breathing, you want to look at circulation, which will tell you how well the child is perfusing. This includes skin color and pattern or obvious significance.
Yeah, TV.
Always remember, it's a life-threatening condition if the child is unresponsive or apneic, has inadequate or labored breathing, or is mild, gray, pale, or cyanotic.
Really pale.
To immediately call for help and begin life-saving treatment.
If there's no life-threatening condition, you'll proceed with the primary assessment. But now, let's practice the PAT, the initial assessment. You'll watch a scene that represents an emergency situation you might encounter. Then we'll stop to let you make your initial assessment.
All right, let's assess a child. Okay, by the way, there are 85, like, slides. I am currently on slide 16. I've been procrastinating. I've been procrastinating so bad. But the videos are actually really nice. Aww. So there's, like, this a video of a little baby who has a pacifier, and he's wheezing and snoring, and I can see substernal, suprasternal retractions, substernal intercostal retractions as well, belly breathing. Oh my goodness, that's a lot. Does this patient need immediate intervention? Yes. Yes is the correct answer. What is the patient's appearance? This is a blonde 18-month-old child with a pacifier. What is the patient's appearance? Awake. Awake is the correct answer. What is the patient's work of breathing? Increased work of breathing. Dual. Next. What is the patient's color? Pale. Correct. All right, here we go. That was easy. We're zooming through this. Okay, so we take this kid's temperature now. The kid seems fine. A three-year-old in a yellow shirt. He's just chilling, and you just stick a temperature probe under his tongue, and he's fine. He doesn't need immediate intervention. What's the patient's appearance? Increased interaction. It asks if they're lethargic or fussy, and they are not. What is the patient's work of breathing? Normal. What is the patient's color? Pink mucous membranes. We actually didn't even see their mucous membranes. That's a lie.
Now that we've practiced the initial assessment, let's move on to the primary assessment. This is a rapid hands-on A, B, C, D, E assessment. And you'll assess the child's airway, breathing circulation, disability, and exposure. We'll start with the airway and breathing sections of the primary assessment.
Now, the first thing you want to do is determine if the upper airway is patent and maintainable. Maintainable means that the airway can be kept patent or maintained with simple measures like positioning, suctioning, or insertion of an oral pharyngeal airway, or an OPA. Now, in an unresponsive child, open the airway by using the head, tail, chin lift maneuver. Place one hand on the child's forehead and push with your palm to tilt the head back. At the same time, place the fingers of the other hand under the bony part of the lower jaw near the chin. You lift the jaw to bring the chin forward. This will lift the child's tongue, relieving a possible airway obstruction. Do not use your thumb to lift the chin, and do not press deeply into the soft tissue under the chin because this might block the airway.
If the airway isn't patent or can't be made patent by using simple maneuvers, you'll need to insert an advanced airway.
If you recognize that the airway is patent, assess breathing. And to do that, you need to evaluate several aspects of the child's respiratory function. Is his breathing pattern regular? What about the respiratory rate? Is that normal for his age? If not, is it too fast or too slow? Are they trying to increase efforts such as nasal flaring, head bobbing, chest retractions, or seesaw respirations? And if you see any of these signs of increased effort, do they occur during inspiration, expiration, or both? Do you hear any gross audible sounds such as a strider, barking cough, or snoring? Mm-hmm. Is he grunting? You have to make sure to take all of these into consideration. For checking a child's breathing, one of the key things you want to assess is chest expansion. Look for chest rise and fall with respirations. Chest expansion should be equal on both sides. Also look for prolonged inspiration and prolonged expiration. This is the time to chest exhale. It typically represents lower airway stretch.
I like
such as
the actors they use in this video.
Listen to the following areas. Front of the chest, just to the left and right of the sternum.
It's actually very accurate.
And both sides of the back. Is the air movement normal or decreased? Compare breath sounds on the left side to those on the right, and compare sounds in the front to those in the back. Listen for abnormal sounds, such as wheezes or crackles, and determine if air movement is normal, decreased, or unequal. Here's a clip of a real patient in respiratory distress. Note the expiratory wheezes along with a rapid respiratory rate and increased respiratory effort.
Aw, poor baby. Well, that's a cool nebulizer.
Pulse oximetry generally gives an accurate estimate of hemoglobin oxygen saturation, but does not provide evidence of oxygen delivery. It also does not provide information about carbon dioxide elimination, which is referred to as ventilation. During shock and cardiac arrest, systemic blood flow is severely compromised, and for a pulse oximeter to calculate the hemoglobin saturation with oxygen, it needs to detect pulse and blood flow. If the child's pulses are extremely weak, the pulse oximeter may not be able to detect hemoglobin saturation, or the results may be inaccurate. And remember, your focus should be on supporting and treating the child, not the device. If the oxygen saturation is less than 94% and the child's breathing room air, this indicates hypoxemia. If the child is in respiratory distress, identify whether it's mild or severe. Following signs indicate that the child is in severe distress and may progress to respiratory failure, so the child requires immediate care. Decreased level of consciousness, very rapid or inadequate respiratory rate, significantly increased or inadequate respiratory effort, and low oxygen saturation or cyanosis, despite high concentration of oxygen. Children with respiratory distress usually have an increased pulse rate. If a child in respiratory failure develops bradycardia, this is a sign of impending cardiac arrest. Call for help.
Yeah.
Then open the airway.
Oh, yeah.
Bad mass ventilation.
Now that we've discussed airway,
bradycardia,
C, D, E.
That scares the shit out of me.
And exposure components of the primary assessment. To assess circulation, you'll check the heart rate and rhythm, pulses, capillary refill time, skin color and temperature, and blood pressure. While the assessment of heart rate is very important when evaluating a child's circulation, alterations in a child's heart rate can provide significant clues to the severity of illness or injury and response to treatment. Age and a number of clinical conditions can affect a child's heart rate. When evaluating the heart rate, first consider if it's normal for age. Anxiety, pain, agitation.
Aww, cute baby.
If the heart rate is less than 60 beats per minute with signs of poor perfusion, despite adequate oxygenation and ventilation, you must provide CPR immediately. Feel the central pulses, such as the carotid or femoral in a child, or brachial in an infant. Also feel the peripheral pulses, such as the radial pulse. Another sign of poor perfusion may be capillary refill. Mm-hmm. Normal capillary refill time is 2 seconds or less. However, delayed capillary refill time is not always abnormal. Other important assessments of perfusion include skin color and temperature. Look to see if the skin is pale or mottled. Note if the skin is warm or cool. Look for cyanosis in the skin, nail beds, and mucous membranes. And compare the color and palpable temperature of the trunk with the color and temperature of the extremities. When the child develops poor perfusion, the hands and feet may become much cooler than the trunk. The final component of circulation assessment is blood pressure. When you're measuring the blood pressure, the length of the cuff should extend to cover at least 50 to 75% of the upper arm, from the axilla to the antecubital fossa. In addition, the bladder inside the cuff should cover no more than about 40% of the mid-upper arm circumference. A cuff that's too large will give falsely low values, and a cuff that's too small will give falsely high values. Take note of whether the systolic blood pressure is normal or abnormal for children 1 to 10 years old by using the following formula. The normal systolic blood pressure for children 1 to 10 years of age is about 90 millimeters of mercury, plus 2 times the child's age in years. Hypertension for children 1 to 10 years of age is a systolic blood pressure of less than 70 millimeters of mercury, plus 2 times their age in years. Mm. If you can't palpate this with pulses, the automated blood pressure device may not accurately measure the blood pressure. In addition, automated blood pressure cuffs may provide inaccurately high readings when the child's in shock. For this reason, if the child's in shock, an arterial catheter is often inserted to monitor the child's intra-arterial pressure. This intra-arterial pressure measurement should be very accurate if the system is properly set up and the catheter is patent.
It's important to know that children can be in shock but still have a normal blood pressure. Hypertension is usually a late sign of shock, so you want to intervene well in advance. Why is it very rapidly? It's scary how quickly it can happen.
Now that we've discussed circulation, let's move on to the next step of the primary assessment, disability. This entails assessing the child's level of consciousness, pupillary responses, and glucose.
To assess a child's level of consciousness, we use the ABPU or AFBU, pediatric response scale. This is a mnemonic you can refer to when assessing a child's level of consciousness. Anyway, is the child alert, responsive to voice?
AFBU? Wait, alert, voice, pain, unresponsive.
Only response to pain or unresponsive. The child does not respond to voice, assess the child's response to a painful stimulus, such as a sternal rub.
I thought we don't do sternal rubs anymore.
We're performing a pupil check, to check for size, symmetry, and reaction to light. Unequal pupils may suggest a serious problem, such as increased intracranial pressure or an eye injury. Normally, the pupil rapidly constricts in response to light. In addition, if you shine a light into one eye, the other eye should normally constrict. This is called consensual constriction. Slow constriction.
What? It's called consensual constriction? I thought it was just called accommodation. Pupils equal reactive. Pupils equal round reactive to light and accommodation. Perla. Anyways.
Or no constriction may indicate increased intracranial pressure. If one or both pupils are dilated, particularly if they don't react to light, the child may have a severe and life-threatening increase in intracranial pressure and require immediate evaluation and treatment.
For any seriously ill child, you should obtain a point-of-care glucose level concentration as soon as possible to evaluate for the presence of hypoglycemia and hyperglycemia.
Yeah, if their pupils are blown, essentially they just have like a full-blown stroke.
Now let's move on to the final step of the primary assessment, exposure. This component focuses on monitoring the child's temperature and examining the skin for evidence of injury, bleeding, or rashes. When you're performing the exposure part of the primary assessment, you perform a complete head-to-toe visual examination of the skin and body, including the patient's back and perineal area. You should look for evidence of trauma, such as bleeding, burns, bruising, or other types of injuries. Also, look for the presence of any type of discoloration or rash, such as petechiae or purpura, which are non-blanching purple discolorations in the skin caused by bleeding from capillaries and small vessels. Check the child's temperature. Note if the temperature is normal, high, or low. Although infections are usually associated with fever, serious infections, especially in infants and immunocompromised children, may cause hypothermia. Let's break to practice the primary assessment scale you've learned. See a typical emergency situation you might encounter in your work. Then we'll stop to let you make your initial assessment.
Well, I remember when I did this a few years back. My instructor was so funny. She's like, you have a child at a barbecue, and you're at a barbecue, and your friend has like a one-year-old baby. All of a sudden, they're feeding the one-year-old baby a piece of steak, and the baby starts choking on the steak. What do you do? And then we all had to like rush to the baby mannequin and do the 5 back slaps. Then she's like, the baby's now unresponsive and pulseless. What do you do? And it was like, you have to go through like these scenarios. They're actually kind of funny. Hey, everybody. Oh, poor baby. Oh, patient with the dragon nebulizer. Does this patient need an immediate intervention? Yes. Heart rate 170s, I mean. Oh my god, respiratory rate is in the 90s? Oh no. I was like, respiratory rate in the 90s? That's impossible. Respiratory rate is 68. SpO2 is 91. Blood pressure is 82 over 59. Okay. So they're tachycardic, tachypneic. I don't know how old this kid is, but I guess kind of hypotensive if they're kind of like a 5, if they're over like the age of 5. But like this kid looks like he's 3, so his blood pressure looks fine. Diminished lung sounds with wheezes. Okay, so it's all this like respiratory stuff. Is the airway maintainable? Well, he has wheezes, but I guess, yeah, because if it wasn't maintainable, they'd have to put a vent in him. Okay, so that was correct. I mean, they'd have to put a tube in his throat. Is the breathing adequate? No, definitely not. Oh, yeah, I got them all right. Amazing.
Oh, such a cute baby. Oh. Oh. Oh, the baby moving.
I mean, the baby looks fine to me. What? The baby needs intervention? What happened to this baby? The baby's lethargic? Oh no, this baby looks very lethargic. It's like they have like abnormal breathing patterns. So this is literally a newborn. Newborn. Their heart rate is like 60s to 70s. They're, oh my God, their oxygen is 71. They're, respiratory rate is in the 50s and their cap refill is 4 seconds. Holy moly. Get oxygen to that baby stat. What is the condition? Hypoxemia. Holy crap. 70. What is your assessment? What are they do? Are they in shock, hypotensive, shock compensated, called cardiopulmonary failure, or respiratory distress? Obviously respiratory. Wait, what? Shock, hypotensive, shock compensated, cardiopulmonary failure? Oh, because the heart rate is really low. Okay, that was right. It's cardiopulmonary failure because the heart rate was also low and the oxygen was low. My bad. Baby not daijoubu.
After the primary assessment, you'll perform an in-depth secondary assessment. In addition to providing a thorough physical examination, a healthcare provider with pediatric advanced life support training should gather additional information about the patient and the incident that resulted in the need for medical care. Caregivers, primarily parents, other family members, and babysitters will generally provide most of the information. The sample mnemonic provides a memory aid to help you recall important medical information necessary to provide you the best care for your young patients. These topics include signs and symptoms, allergies, medications, past medical history, last meal, and the events leading to the injury or illness.
I'm just going
to
look. I'm just going to curl some weights while I'm doing this.
Systematic manner. S stands for signs and symptoms. A sign is an observation that you
can get the 5 pounds.
Assessing patient, like patient's wheezing. Examples of these signs include
cardio
or diaphoresis.
Why not?
It's a problem or complaint that the patient or the patient's caregiver reports to you, such as shortness of breath, abdominal pain, decreased appetite, or headache. The next thing you want to do is ask about allergies. Are there any known medication and food allergies? What are the associated reactions? Right. Food allergies may affect a child's care. After allergies, ask about medications, including over-the-counter meds, vitamins, or supplements. The patient's medications can There's a possibility that the child's symptoms result in a drug overdose. It is important to ask the caregiver what medications can be found in the child's living environment. Once you know the child's medications, obtain the past medical history. That includes the child's previous illnesses, hospitalizations, surgeries, and immunizations. Past medical history can often provide insight to the child's current clinical presentation. For instance, a history of coughing at night may suggest asthma as a possible reason for a child's current trouble breathing.
But once you know the medical history, ask about the child's last meal. Knowing when and what the child last ate or drank is important. In case of serious anaphylactic shock, the child ingested may be the actual cause of the condition. The time that has elapsed between the last meal and presentation of current illness can often dictate treatment and management of the condition. Pediatric emergency sometimes requires surgery, in which case the surgical or anesthesia team will want to know when and what the child last ate or drank.
The final component in the sample review is events. The events leading up to the current presentation. Healthcare providers should obtain an accurate timeline for all signs, symptoms, and events leading up to the current presentation.
All right, next video, please. 1, 2, 3.
Products are shown for demonstration purposes only. The AHA does not endorse or recommend any specific manufacturer or product. In order to show skills clearly, the healthcare providers in this video do not always use recommended personal protective equipment, such as gloves. The following information represents American Heart Association guidelines and best practices for measuring and improving the basic life support skills of the team.
My 8 pounders.
One of the measures of a high-performance team is the ability to achieve specific performance metrics and a high chest compression fraction, or CCF.
CCF
is the amount of time spent doing high-quality chest compressions during a cardiac arrest
event. Okay.
You can only achieve a high CCF.
Okay, this is kind of funny because I sped up the video times 2. And they look like they're doing CPR so fast. They're speed CPRing on them. It's so funny.
By eliminating causes during high-quality
CPR. The
Resuscitation Outcomes Consortium, or ROC trials, showed that a 10% increase in CCF is roughly equal to an 11% increase in survival. Pauses typically occur during intubation, rhythm analysis, pulse checks, compressor switches, and defibrillation. We'll address some best practices for eliminating pauses.
Oh my God, they're zooming.
You'll metrics at your own place of practice to identify other areas where pauses exist.
They're zooming so fast.
Whenever compressions are paused, compressors should hover over the chest and be prepared to resume compressions.
Oh, they're very thorough about this now.
15 seconds before pausing compressions at the end of each 2-minute cycle. High performance teams should check for a pulse as a placeholder, pre-charge the defibrillator, and be prepared to deliver a shock in 10 seconds or less.
145.
Okay, let's go ahead and charge up.
Charging.
We have good pulses with CPR?
Good final pulses with CPR still.
All right.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 2 minutes.
Okay, let's stop CPR.
No femoral pulses without CPR.
Okay, that's a shock. Low rhythm, shock.
Shocking. Shock delivered.
CPR.
Wow.
Starting 2 minutes.
They are
switch
so
compressors
efficient.
The second compressor coming in from behind first. This allows the second compressor to have the same view of the team, and in particular, of the AED or defibrillator. Mm. For seamless transitions, switching between cycles every 2 minutes is best. However, if a compressor needs to switch because of fatigue, coordinate the switch to happen as fluidly as possible, such as while delivering breaths.
Mm. 3, 2, 1, switch. Cool. That was smooth.
It's a best practice to use real-time feedback devices during CPR. However, if a feedback device isn't available, a metronome can help establish the proper rate. If your AED or defibrillator doesn't have a metronome, you can download a metronome app.
Oh, that's smart. Use a metronome
Another
for CPR.
Another element of high-performance teams is effective team dynamics. Team dynamics
Why
can be broken down into
before?
Roles to communicate and how to communicate. Clear roles and responsibilities should be immediately established by the team leader or the first rescuer on the scene. When all team members know their roles and responsibilities during a resuscitation attempt, the team functions smoothly. I'll be on
airway.
Can you hear me
a video? I want to be the recorder. I just want to stand there and record everything.
Not when the situation deteriorates.
I'm getting pretty tired of these compressions. Who needs some help after this?
Sometimes a team member or team leader may need to correct actions that are incorrect or inappropriate. It's important to be tactful, especially if you need to correct a colleague before they make a mistake.
And now you're too fast. Target heart rate is 110.
The next category is what to communicate. Knowledge sharing and summarizing information are critical components of effective team performance. Team leaders should review what's happened and ask for ideas and observations from team members.
Can you give me a recap, Nick?
Yes, we've been doing CPR for about 4.5 minutes. We've got 1 shock, 2 no-shocks, and you've given 1 dose of MVID.
Okay, so anybody have any ideas on what else we can try with this patient?
Finally, how to communicate. Closed-loop communication is the process of verifying that the message sent was received as intended. It also verifies that any assigned tasks have been completed.
So, Scott, why don't you give 1 milligram of epinephrine?
Scott!
In addition to using closed-loop communication, teams should use clear messaging. Concise, clear language helps prevent misunderstandings. Teams that work together frequently can create terms or phrases that have specific meaning for them to ensure clarity among members.
Okay, let's go ahead and charge up.
Charging.
We have good pulses. Actually,
I really love how all the nurses in this video are male.
In a professional manner, regardless of scope of practice or
expertise. And the doctor is female. Look at that.
Understand that this is the nature of CPR, and remember the life you're trying to save. It's not enough to know what to do or even how to do to obtain the best results.
Female doctor
and the how
flawlessly. That leading the code right now, and all of the nurses are male.
Set goals to improve.
It's actually really interesting.
Remember, you cannot improve. You do not
measure. Did that on purpose.
For more information on how your team can implement this type of program, please ask your instructor for more information.
It's actually really cool. Like, actually, that's really cool. Okay, team dynamics. CPR coach.
Products are shown for demonstration purposes only. The AHA does not endorse or recommend any specific manufacturer or product. In order to show skills clearly, the healthcare providers in this video do not always use recommended personal protective equipment, such as gloves. To help improve your assessment skills, the American Heart Association training series includes videos of actual children with medical problems. Of course, at no time was medical care delayed for the purpose of obtaining this video. All children received timely and appropriate medical care, and parents provided consent before recording. The following information represents American Heart Association guidelines and best practices for measuring and improving the basic life support skills of the teams you work with. The successful resuscitation of a patient in cardiac arrest requires a coordinated team effort. Effective teams have providers with well-defined roles.
We're almost halfway, guys.
To prioritize and complete critical tasks.
We're almost halfway.
The team leader is responsible for coordinating these tasks and ensuring that clinical care is delivered according to American Heart Association guidelines. Delivering high-quality CPR while minimizing pauses optimizes outcomes after cardiac arrest. But because of competing priorities, it can be difficult for team leaders to continuously monitor and provide feedback on CPR quality. The CPR coach is a new role within the resuscitation team and is designed to address these difficulties and promote the delivery of high-quality CPR.
CPR coach.
The presence of a CPR coach allows the team leader to focus on other elements of cardiac arrest care. Whether you're a basic life support provider or an advanced life support provider, the role of CPR coach exists to help you and your team deliver high-quality CPR.
Well, I was already like
to implement the role of a, CPR
a
coach
third
is
the of the way when I started
device.
This.
We'll discuss some of the functions of the CPR coach and how they use feedback devices. First, let's talk about the team layout when using a CPR coach. CPR coaches should stand across from the compressor, always in the compressor's direct line of sight.
Mm.
CPR coaches should also stand next to the CPR feedback display, which is often located on the defibrillator,
wow.
So that they can effortlessly redirect the compressor's attention to the data provided by the feedback device. Now that the CPR coach is in place, they should verbalize the data from the feedback device, providing corrective and positive feedback, such as push harder or your rate is good.
Great job. You're right on target.
You know the reason why we lift weights is so we can do good CPR, good quality CPR, high quality CPR. We need to build those CPR
gains.
And now you're too fast.
You have to do 100 to 120 compressions per minute. That's a lot.
Analyzing the rhythm,
that's a lot. That's like 100 curls a minute.
The goal of the coach is to keep all pauses to 5 seconds or less when possible. Switch.
Okay, that's up. Go ahead and start. Clear. Shock. Resume.
Except for intubation. Intubation should be performed by skilled providers, ideally without stopping compressions.
Okay, through the port.
But if it's necessary to pause for intubation, the pause must be for 10 seconds or less.
I'm still having trouble. Go ahead and pause CPR. Okay, there we go. Through the port. Continue.
It's really sad when you, like, do CPR for, like, hours and then it, like, doesn't help.
It takes practice and training. If you'd like to learn more about how you can incorporate CPR coach role into your resuscitation team, please ask for
instructions. When we do CPR on, like, babies and stuff for coding, like, you'll get a pulse back and you'll get return of spontaneous circulation and all that. But then they'll immediately decompensate right afterwards and you can never get them back to, like, a stable... like a stable heart rhythm. So it's like, as even though as many times you're able to get back their heart rate, they like flatline immediately. So I remember this one time we were doing it and I think we were able to get back the pulse and the heart rate 3 times, but then after that it's just like we try to get it back a 4th time and then that, it just didn't work. And I think the code was like almost 2 hours. So yeah, sometimes even though like you get the return of the pulse and stuff, it still might not be the end. So what is chest compression fraction? The question is asking, what is chest compression fraction? Proportion of time that compressions are performed, proportion of time that depth is adequate in compressions, proportion of time that compressions are not performed, or proportion of time that recoil is adequate. Proportion of time that compressions are performed? Yeah. Yeah, high beep VM as well, and you have to do it for a long time. But luckily with kids, you don't have to push down as hard because they're small. So that's why it's a lot easier to do it. But the worst part of doing CPR on anybody and any age is... the ribs, the cracking of the ribs, like, I want to say, like, 90% of the time, their ribs will, like, get cracked in some way, and it's not a fun sound to hear, but at the same time, you're, like, in emergency, so you can't have to kind of just, like, ignore it, so the ribs cracking are, oof, it's, like, a sound you never want to hear, ever. What chest compression fraction is recommended and what goal is often achievable with good teamwork? Mm. 80% to 100%? Wait, I don't actually know what. What chest compression fraction is recommended and what goal is often achievable? Oh, achievable. Okay, 60% and 80%. There we go. Let's go.
Products are shown for demonstration purposes only. The AHA does not endorse or recommend any specific manufacturer or product. In order to show skills clearly, the healthcare providers in this video do not always use recommended personal protective equipment, such as gloves. To help improve your assessment skills, the American Heart Association training series...
Respiratory 90, this kid is vibrating. They're on an oscillator.
All children receive timely...
Actually, that's not funny. Being on an oscillator is not funny.
Learning how to assess and effectively manage a respiratory emergency is a crucial skill for a healthcare provider. In this segment, we'll review the unique characteristics of the pediatric airway. Learn to recognize the various types of pediatric respiratory emergencies.
You get a lot, like the biggest emergency we get.
First, of a child's airway.
These is a hospital a respiratory
are considerably smaller
problem.
And shorter than those of adults. The adult larynx is cylindrical, with the narrowest opening at the level of the vocal cords. In contrast, the larynx of infants and young children is funnel-shaped. The airway continues to taper below the vocal cords to the cricoid cartilage, which is the narrowest point of the airway, and it creates a non-distensible ring around the airway. In infants and toddlers, the tongue and epiglottis are relatively large and can contribute to airway obstruction. In addition, the larynx is positioned more superiorly and anteriorly than adults. Note that the airway is always
anterior. Oh my god.
And the cricoid cartilage is the only complete cartilage ring located below the vocal cords. Keep these anatomic and physiologic details in mind when we discuss various respiratory emergencies and their treatment.
As you would with any seriously ill child, you should use the evaluate, identify, intervene sequence to respond to a pediatric respiratory emergency. When assessing a child, there are basically 4 different types of respiratory problems to identify: upper airway obstruction, lower airway obstruction, lung tissue disease, and disordered control of breathing.
This child with upper airway obstruction, such as croup, typically has increased respiratory rate and effort. Signs of increased effort include retractions and nasal flaring. Retractions occur in children because of their increased chest wall compliance and the negative intrathoracic pressure. A child with upper airway obstruction often has inspiratory
strain. I called like 5 RRTs last week for like a bunch of kids on respiratory distress. Everyone be catching viruses now.
In a way that makes their breathing easier. They should be allowed to remain in a position of comfort.
Literally.
A child with lower airway obstruction, such as asthma or bronchiolitis, also has increased respiratory rate and effort. an auscultation, air movement may be decreased, exhalation may be prolonged, and you can usually hear expiratory wheezes. A child with lung tissue disease, such as pneumonia, demonstrates increased respiratory rate and effort that may include grunting. Crackles and decreased air movement may be present. A child with disordered control of breathing, such as a child with brain injury or drug overdose, may have an irregular breathing pattern. The respiratory rate is often slow, and breathing may be shallow with inadequate respiratory effort. Air movement may be normal or decreased.
Yeah, I mean,
a child with
respiratory
disordered control of breathing may have poor muscle tone or decreased level of consciousness, causing upper airway obstruction.
Once you identify the category of respiratory emergency, you can then intervene.
Yeah, they're really scary or like really
chill. For infants, holding the best position might be in the arms of the parent or caregiver. Allowing the child to remain in a comfortable position often decreases the child's anxiety and subsequent mortal breathing. A common respiratory intervention for children is administering inhaled medications by using a nebulizer.
It's true. Like, I have this kid who like poops. And literally every time he would cry, holy crap.
Oxygen source or compressed air. The nebulized medications are used to treat airway obstruction
the
by opening
the sound he would make when he breathes was like he was gasping. It would sound like like that. Like extreme strider every time he would cry. But then when he was sleeping, it was fine. And we had to call a rapid on him.
Oxygen concentration delivered by the system is determined by the flow rate.
We gave like so many rap FEs that night. That's racemic epinephrine, which is a type of epinephrine that you inhale.
High flow systems may be helpful for these patients.
Wait, just what happened when?
These systems include a mask that is
there's like an obstruction or whatever, like they have trouble breathing because of inflammation. Epinephrine just like reduces the swelling.
Easily deliver consistently high concentration of oxygen approaching 100%. Non-rebreathing face masks are always connected directly to oxygen. The oxygen flow rate for the mask must be at 10 to 15 liters per minute. The flow rate should be adequate to keep the reservoir bag partially expanded. If the mask is tight-fitting, one-way valves ensure the child breathes only oxygen from the oxygen source of the reservoir. No room air is drawn in. Non-rebreathing masks should be used in emergency settings when the patient is breathing spontaneously, but high concentrations of oxygen are required to maintain oxygen saturations.
Another high-flow system you'll encounter is the high-flow nasal cannula. These have become very common in the inpatient ICU settings. Now, the flow can be adjusted from 4 liters in infants up to 40 liters or more adolescents. You can also titrate the flow to provide additional inspiratory and expiratory.
I like the high flows.
High-flow nasal cannula systems deliver a combination of both room air and oxygen. They allow healthcare providers the flexibility to also titrate oxygen concentration based on the patient's needs and saturations.
In the most serious respiratory emergencies, effective ventilation may require positive pressure. In these circumstances, the use of a bag mask device is the most important life-saving skill you can perform. Bag mask ventilation using a bag with an oxygen reservoir can deliver an oxygen concentration near 100%. This requires an oxygen flow rate of at least 10 liters per minute. When properly performed, bag mask ventilation can be as effective as ventilation through an endotracheal tube for short periods of time.
When bag mask ventilation is needed, healthcare providers must be ready to perform two other interventions, suctioning the airway and inserting an oral airway.
Mm. When supporting the airway and breathing of a child, you may find you need to clear the airway. That may include suctioning of secretions, blood, or vomitus. Suction devices can be either portable or wall-mounted. Those used in children should have adjustable suction regulators so that you can minimize tissue trauma. Semi-rigid pharyngeal tips and various sizes of catheters should be available. Complications from suctioning may include hypoxia, vagal stimulation, bradycardia, gagging and vomiting, soft tissue injury, and agitation that may further compromise the patient's cardiorespiratory status.
To suction the oral pharynx, gently insert the distal end of the suction catheter into the oral pharynx over the tongue. Guide it into the posterior pharynx and apply suction by covering the catheter side opening. At the same time, withdraw the catheter with a rotating or twisting motion. Try to limit suction attempts to 10 seconds or less. This will help reduce the risk of hypoxemia. You may give short periods of 100% oxygen immediately before and after each suctioning attempt. Monitor the child's heart rate, oxygen saturation, and clinical appearance during suctioning. In general, if bradycardia develops or clinical appearance deteriorates, interrupt suctioning and deliver oxygen and bag mask ventilation if needed until the heart rate and clinical appearance return to normal. Insert oral pharyngeal airway is another intervention that healthcare providers must know how to do. Oral pharyngeal airways are used in unconscious patients with no gag reflex. They help maintain the airway by preventing the tongue from obstructing the tracheal opening or glottis. Well, an appropriately sized oral airway should extend the child's jaw when the airway is positioned next to the face. If the device is too large, it may block the airway, and if it's too small, it can cause the tongue to obstruct the airway.
Mm.
One technique to facilitate insertion of the oral pharyngeal airway is to use a tongue blade to depress the tongue. The oral airway should not be used in conscious response in children. It'll likely cause a gag reflex and vomiting. Often, an oral airway will not provide sufficient airway support, and you'll need to insert an advanced airway. For example, if it's difficult to provide effective bag mask ventilation, if the patient has actual or potential airway compromise, particularly with long transport times, or
if we need to intubate a kid,
because
like we know they're going to decompensate, we just like sedate them.
And eliminating the need to interrupt chest compressions to deliver breaths during CPR.
Super quickly,
if an advanced airway is inserted during CPR,
put a sedation through IV,
and how long you interrupt chest compressions for
intubation. And then we intubate them so that they don't gag on it.
While continuous chest compressions are delivered without interruptions. Another advanced airway device is the laryngeal mask airway. This device offers two key advantages. It can be inserted without directly visualizing the glottis, and it can be used as a rescue device when endotracheal intubation cannot be accomplished. If sudden deterioration is observed in a patient with an advanced airway, it may be caused by one of several complications. You can use the mnemonic DOPE to help remedy these. The airway may be displaced. For example, an endotracheal tube may be pulled out of the trachea or advanced into the right or left main bronchus.
DOPE.
Obstruction of the airway may be caused by secretions, blood, pus, or
formic.
Thinking of the airway may also cause acute obstruction, particularly in smaller endotracheal tubes. A pneumothorax usually results in decreased chest expansion and breath sounds on the affected side. A sudden deterioration in a patient's pulse oximetry may occur. In severe cases, hypotension and even cardiac arrest may occur. It rarely happens, but sometimes your equipment can fail. Disconnection from the oxygen supply, power failure to mechanical ventilator, malfunction of valves, or a leak in the bag mask device or circuit. Respiratory problems are the most common pediatric emergencies. That's why it's essential that you understand the unique characteristics of the pediatric airway and you know how to recognize and manage these life-threatening conditions.
Yeah, I like my when I first had to do like bag valve mask on a kid who was coding, he had a tracheostomy, so like a hole in his neck with a breathing tube in there, and he had like dislodged it, so I stuck it back in, and then the bag valve mask actually fits over most tracheostomies, so I like stuck it on his trach, and then I started bagging him, but I didn't know that I was bagging him too hard, because like you can blow their lungs if you accidentally push too hard on the bag valve mask. So like they said you have to just monitor for the rise and fall, and just wait in between like the breath, the rise and fall of the chest. And but I was like so worried because like literally the baby was, the heart rate was like going below 60. Their oxygen was like 50 and they were turning blue and they were unresponsive. Holy crap, my heart was racing so hard. But they came really fast, and luckily after we started bagging them, they like literally in less than a minute they like woke up. So it was really good. I'm about to pass out, yeah. All right, there's more video, watching videos. Labored breathing and gurgling. Oh, poor baby. Does this patient need immediate intervention? No. Because they're sleeping, I guess, or they're just chilling. Heart rate 130. Because they have a nasal cannula on, their oxygen's in 94. Their respiratory rate's in the 30s. Yeah, they're Gucci. They're fine. They're chilling. All right, so a 3-year-old with a nasal cannula and diaper lying on mom's chest. Child with special healthcare needs. What is your assessment? Respiratory distress. Definitely not respiratory failure. Just respiratory distress, lower airway obstruction, I assume. Or lung tissue disease? I think it might be lung tissue disease. Yeah, like bronchiolitis. Yeah. Respiratory video, blah, blah, blah. What intervention is most appropriate to do next? Administer intravenous antibiotics. Administer nebulized epinephrine? I don't think so. They're not, like, croupy. I guess give antibiotics, right? Right. Because they have an infection, pneumonia. Aww, this cute baby too. Wait, I actually have to lower the speed because it's not accurate. Hold up. Aw, he's belly breathing. Sounds all right. Yeah, he's chilling. Yeah, cute 3-year-old, but he's just chilling on the bed. A little bit tachypneic. But his sats are fine, 97. Respiratory distress. Lower airway obstruction. So what would we do? Albuterized. What is this? Albuterized. No, yeah, this is for like asthma. Administer nebulized albuterol and ipratropium bromide. That's what we usually give for asthma. Wait, what is
for demonstration purposes only? The AHA does not endorse or recommend any specific manufacturer or product. In order to show skills clearly, The healthcare providers in this video do not always use recommended personal protective equipment, such as gloves. To help improve your assessment skills, the American Heart Association training series includes videos of actual children with medical problems. Of course, at no time was medical care delayed for the purpose of obtaining this video. All children received timely and appropriate medical care, and parents provided consent before recording. Shock is a life-threatening medical condition. In this segment, we'll review the various types of shock that can affect children and model how to effectively treat the condition. Shock is a condition of circulatory failure that results in inadequate delivery of oxygen and other nutrients to the tissues. Shock can be present with a low, normal, or even high cardiac output. The cardiac output is inadequate to meet tissue oxygen needs. Shock is progressive, so mild shock requires urgent care to avoid cardiac arrest. Because shock is progressive, a child in shock will deteriorate and may deteriorate rapidly. As a result, it's critical to identify the signs of shock and provide treatment as soon as possible. There are four types of shock: hypovolemic, distributive, cardiogenic, and obstructive. Let's explore each of these.
Hypovolemic shock is the most common type of shock in children worldwide and is the result of volume loss due to vomiting, diarrhea, bleeding, or inadequate fluid intake. Signs of hypovolemic shock include tachycardia and poor perfusion. The level of consciousness may be normal at first, but it will decrease as shock progresses. During the initial stages of hypovolemic shock, the blood pressure may actually be high due to the release of catecholamines. As shock progresses, the blood pressure will fall. If hypotension is present, immediate treatment is needed to prevent cardiac arrest. Well, distributive shock is present when there is inadequate blood flow to some tissue beds, but too much blood flow to others. It is typically associated with vasodilation and some capillary leak and decreased heart function. The clinical presentation of distributive shock is more variable than that of hypovolemic shock. Like children with hypovolemic shock, most children with distributive shock have tachycardia. Some also have a typical sign of poor perfusion, which is cool skin with delayed capillary refill. Unlike patients in hypovolemic shock, however, some patients in distributive shock may have warm, flushed skin with brisk capillary refill. The most common form of distributive shock is septic shock that results from a systemic infection. Severe infections can release toxins that cause the small blood vessels to dilate and to leak fluid into the tissues. Septic shock is generally preceded by signs and symptoms of infection, such as fever. With some types of infections, the child may develop a petechial or purpuric rash. Progression of septic shock may occur over hours. Another common form of distributive shock is anaphylaxis that typically results from a severe allergic reaction. The allergen can cause the release of chemicals within the body that make the small blood vessels dilate and leak fluid into tissues, like septic shock. However, anaphylactic shock can develop extremely fast, often within just minutes.
Cardiogenic shock results from inadequate tissue perfusion caused by poor myocardial function. Common causes include congenital heart disease, myocarditis, or acquired dysfunctions such as cardiomyopathy. Other less common causes include arrhythmias, sepsis, drug toxicity, or direct myocardial injury. With cardiogenic shock, children often have marred tachycardia, accompanied by very high systemic vascular resistance and severe vasoconstriction and decreased cardiac output. Pulmonary congestion may develop, causing respiratory distress. Intravascular volume may be normal or high unless the child has had poor oral intake.
In obstructive shock, cardiac output is impaired by physical obstruction of blood flow into or out of the heart. Obstructions may be caused by air, fluid, or blood clots, such as in tension pneumothorax or cardiac tamponade. Obstructive shock may also be caused by massive pulmonary embolus or result from congenital heart defects that cause severe obstruction to pulmonary, aortic, or systemic blood flow. Many of these lesions are called ductal-dependent lesions that depend on a functional ductus, arteriosus, for pulmonary or systemic blood flow. Once the ductus starts to close after birth, these infants can deteriorate rapidly. Because cardiac output is impaired in both hypovolemic and obstructive shock, it can be difficult to distinguish the two.
After the child has been categorized as having one of the four kinds of shock, it's essential to define the severity as being either compensated or hypotensive. Shock with adequate blood pressure is termed compensated shock.
Patients in compensated shock may have a normal or even high systolic blood pressure due to the fight or flight response. This compensatory mechanism produces systemic vasoconstriction that initially maintains blood pressure. Shock with a low blood pressure is called hypotensive shock. Low blood pressure is defined as a blood pressure less than the fifth percentile for age. Hypotension occurs when the compensatory mechanisms have failed. Hypotensive shock in children is an ominous finding and requires immediate intervention.
Regardless of the type of shock, it's critical that you know about the various devices and procedures used to manage this serious condition. There are several important considerations for monitoring and managing shock. For monitoring patients, place them on a cardiac monitor, continuously measure pulse oximetry, and perform frequent blood pressure measurements. For managing shock, rapid vascular access is needed for fluid therapy and drug administration.
For children in compensated shock, peripheral venous access is preferred if it can be obtained rapidly. But for children in hypotensive shock, immediate vascular access is critical, so team members should be prepared to establish intraosseous or IO access. IV or IO fluid bolus therapy is indicated for treatment of shock. The primary goal of fluid resuscitation in shock is to restore adequate blood flow to the tissue. The rate, the volume of the fluid bolus are determined by the child's condition. The rate of fluid delivery will be affected by the size and the length of the IV catheter. Give fluid boluses rapidly for hypovolemic, distributive, and obstructive shock.
In the case of cardiogenic shock, the fluid bolus should be smaller and given more slowly. Rapid delivery of fluids in the setting of poor myocardial function can cause pulmonary edema and further impair cardiac output. This can further compromise oxygenation, ventilation, and cardiac output. Give a bolus of 5 to 10 milliliters per kilogram of body weight by using isotonic crystalloid. Give the bolus over 10 to 20 minutes. Carefully monitor hemodynamic and respiratory parameters during fluid infusion and repeat subsequent infusions as needed. For a child in shock, the preferred initial fluid for resuscitation is an isotonic crystalloid solution, such as normal saline or lactated Ringer's. Dextrose-containing fluids shouldn't be given for shock resuscitation.
If you do not know the child's weight, use a length-based resuscitation tape to quickly estimate the weight and the fluid bolus volume. Measure from the top of the head to the heel. The child's heel will fall in boxes that list not only the typical fluid bolus for shock, but emergency doses of medication and sizes of emergency equipment that should be used for that child. The typical bolus volume for shock is 20 milliliters per kilogram of body weight of isotonic crystalloid administered over 10 to 20 minutes. The equipment used for routine pediatric intravenous fluid administration may not deliver fluid boluses as rapidly as needed for most children in shock. One way to deliver fluids rapidly is to use a commercially available rapid infusion device. Another option is to set up a rapid push-pull system. Anytime fluid is being administered rapidly, providers must be aware of the risk of air embolism can occur when air gets infused from the fluid bag after all the fluid has been given. Here's how to set up the push-pull system by using commonly available supplies. Follow these steps to give a fluid bolus with a syringe and a three-way stopcock. Verify that the vascular access is patent. Connect a bag of isotonic crystalloid with a three-way stopcock and extension tubing to the IV or IO access. Attach a large syringe to the stopcock. To draw up the IV fluid into the syringe, turn the stopcock off to the child and open between the syringe and the bag of IV fluid. Draw fluid from the bag into the syringe.
Oh yeah, I remember doing this.
Turn the stopcock off to the bag and open between the syringe and the child. To rapidly infuse the fluid bolus from the syringe, push the fluid from the syringe into the child. Repeat these steps until after the total desired volume of fluid bolus is delivered. After the bolus is delivered, turn the stopcock off to the syringe and open between the child and the IV bag. Reset the continuous IV infusion rate as appropriate. Carefully assess the patient after each bolus. Auscultate the lungs and feel for hepatomegaly. If crackles, respiratory distress, or an enlarged liver develop, the child will likely need additional therapy, such as administration of an inotropic drug, for example, epinephrine, or an inodilator, such as milrinone. Some patients in shock may need additional respiratory support, such as continuous positive airway pressure, or CPAP, or intubation and mechanical ventilation after fluid resuscitation. For children with fever but no signs of shock, routine IV fluid boluses are not recommended. There's been no benefit shown in these instances, and there may be harm where access to critical care resources is limited. For patients with suspected septic shock, antibiotics should be administered within the first hour of care. In addition, administration of vasoactive drugs will be needed and should be administered if the child does not respond to initial fluid boluses. For patients with cardiogenic shock, small, more frequent fluid boluses may be needed, but must be done cautiously. Most patients will need inotropic support with medications such as milrinone or epinephrine. For obstructive shock, treatment must be directed at the underlying problem. For example, with tension pneumothorax, needle decompression is required. For cardiac tamponade, pericardiocentesis is indicated. For ductal-dependent congenital heart disease causing obstructive shock, prostaglandin infusion may be life-saving. Certain causes of the obstructive shock, administration of small fluid boluses and vasoactive drugs such as epinephrine may help support cardiac output. You should also seek expert consultation. Knowing how to recognize the signs of shock and treat the condition effectively are essential skills for you to learn. Your ability to manage this condition can save lives.
Fun. Shock is not fun. But the three-way stopcock is fun. Next. All right, there's a baby. Baby's breathing fast-ish. There's some belly breathing. The baby has a G-tube. They look kind of pale. I mean, they look comfortable. I cannot tell. Well, they're pale. Okay, I feel like they're pale. How old is this kid? Heart rate 171. Why don't they just give me the vital signs before? Anyway, 171. Oxygen 96. Respiratory rate 30. Blood pressure 82 over 55. MAP 64. I mean, I think they're tachycardic and compensated something. I don't even know. Capillary refill is really, really low, though. So I think they're having, really high. It's, 9 seconds for their cap refill. So I think they're having, distributive shock. Yeah, compensated distributive shock. Nope, that was wrong. Compensated hypotensive... It is compensated hypovolemic shock. I got it wrong. I hate this. I hate stuff about shock. Shock is hard. Anyways, compensated hypovolemic shock. Administer fluid bolus of 20 ml per kg of isotonic crystalloid. Yes. Next.
There's an older kid. Okay. They're on a nasal cannula. Okay. They look like a teenager. Okay. They're breathing fine.
All right, they're fine. Then I got another one here. Aww. There's a baby crying. Wait, is this a baby or is this an older kid? This looks like an older kid. Their feet are huge. Okay, so heart rate 154, oxygen 96, respiratory rate 27, blood pressure 81 over 46. That's not okay for their age. They are in hypo. They is a 17-year-old female. Wait, that was that girl earlier? That same girl? I think she's septic. Yeah. What kind of septic shock? It's septic shock is a distributive shock, but she's not in compensated distributive shock right now because she's her blood pressure is 80s over 50s, which is like what a newborn's blood pressure should be. So she's hypotensive. Correct. What interventions do you anticipate? Obtain blood cultures after administration of antibiotics? No. B. Administer IV fluids before antibiotics? No. C. Administer intravenous antibiotics within the first 2 hours? I think it was the first hour. Oh, I was right. Okay, great. All right, next. Heart rhythms.
Products are shown for demonstration purposes only. The AHA does not endorse or recommend any specific manufacturer or product. In order to show skill clearly, the healthcare providers in this video do not always use recommended personal protective equipment, such as gloves. To help improve your assessment skills, the American Heart Association training series includes videos of actual children with medical problems. Of course, at no time was medical care delayed for the purpose of obtaining this video. All children received timely and appropriate medical care and parent provided consent for recording. This video addresses the management of arrhythmia, or abnormal heart rhythm, in emergency and pediatric patients. Many of the arrhythmias we discuss have a treatment algorithm that can be found in your provider manual. Refer to them for more information.
To determine appropriate action when evaluating the heart rate and rhythm in any seriously ill or injured child, you must consider the child's typical heart rate and baseline rhythm, and the child's level of activity, age, and clinical condition.
The signs of instability in a patient with arrhythmia are respiratory distress or failure, shock with poor end organ perfusion, which may occur with or without hypotension, irritability or a decreased level of consciousness, chest pain or a vague feeling of comfort in older children, and sudden collapse. Most common pediatric arrhythmias are sinus bradycardia, atrioventricular or AV block, sinus tachycardia, and supraventricular tachycardia. Bradycardia is a lower than normal heart rate. In children, the most serious cause is severe hypoxia. As a result, the initial treatment is bag mask ventilation with 100% oxygen. If the bradycardia persists and the heart rate is less than 60 per minute with poor perfusion, start CPR. Consider giving epinephrine or atropine. AV block is a delay in conduction of the electrical impulse through the heart caused by a problem with the AV node. Many AV blocks require no treatment, while some may result in a very low ventricular rate and can worsen to cardiopulmonary compromise. These AV blocks require a pacemaker. Sinus tachycardia is a rapid heart rate that develops when high cardiac output is needed, such as fever, excitement, and exercise. The presence of sinus tachycardia should prompt a search to identify the underlying cause of the tachycardia. Some causes may be significant or even life-threatening, requiring urgent intervention, while others may be fairly benign and require no intervention or only require ongoing monitoring. Supraventricular tachycardia, or SVT, is the most common arrhythmia in children. SVT is generally characterized by an abrupt increase in heart rate that does not vary with activity. This isn't a life-threatening problem for most children. Emergency treatment is considered only if episodes are prolonged, frequent, or cause cardiorespiratory compromise.
So, I'm going to wait for this video to finish.
Is an uncommon but potentially fatal condition and requires prompt attention. VT may also cause cardiac arrest, which requires CPR and immediate fibrillation for survival. VT may result from serious heart disease, but occasionally occurs in children with otherwise normal hearts. Priorities in the management of arrhythmias are the same as they are for all critically ill children. Support the ABCs: airway, breathing, and circulation.
You know,
and treat the underlying cause.
Because
we've already reviewed the ABCs, we'll now focus on different therapies for specific treatment. We will discuss vagal stimulation as well as pharmacologic and electrical therapies.
I'm going to go pee.
The initial energy dose should be between 0.5 and 1 joule per kilogram.
If
subsequent shocks are required, increase the dose
to
2 joules.
Oh, what are they talking about?
Defibrillation.
Charge
the defibrillator. Charging.
Fun.
Before delivering the shock, firmly communicate to the team
quick.
You are charging
the
defibrillator.
0.5.
Once the team is clear,
to 1 joule per kilo, which is easy.
After the shock,
because if the patient is 30 kilos, you just give 30 joules.
No interventions are necessary. If the tachyarrhythmia persists, prepare to perform cardioversion again at a higher energy dose.
Or,
reset to
15.
Because most defibrillators default to the unsynchronized mode. In the unlikely event ventricular fibrillation or pulseless ventricular tachycardia develops, begin CPR and prepare to deliver an unsynchronized shock as soon as possible.
Mm.
Cardiac arrest is the cessation of blood circulation resulting from absent or ineffective cardiac mechanical activity. Clinically, the child is unresponsive and not breathing or only gasping. There is no detectable pulse.
No pulse. Start CPR.
There are two general pathways that children take to develop cardiac arrest. The most common pathway for children is primarily due to the progression of respiratory failure or hypotensive shock. Either of these will progress to cardiac arrest if unrecognized, untreated, or unresponsive to medical therapies. The other pathway is sudden ventricular arrhythmias, leading to acute cardiac arrest. Unlike in adults, this pathway is very uncommon in children. It is far more likely for children to have cardiac arrest due to progressive respiratory
only
failure or hypotensive
more.
Shock. Cardiac arrest states include a systemic pulseless electrical activity, ventricular fibrillation, and pulseless ventricular tachycardia, including torsades de pointe. For all these cardiac arrest states, CPR should be performed and
favorite.
Emergency medications should be provided in accordance with the pediatric cardiac arrest algorithm.
Torsades
in pulseless electrical
point.
Activity, PEA, organized electrical activity is present on the cardiac monitor, but the patient remains pulseless. A systole, ventricular fibrillation, and ventricular tachycardia are not considered organized electrical activity. Cardiac arrest can be caused by precipitating and potentially reversible conditions requiring immediate intervention. These causes of cardiac arrest can be recalled by remembering the H's and T's. Hypoglycemia is low serum glucose. Hypovolemia is low blood volume.
Hypoxia
occurs when inadequate oxygen is reaching
ion,
the body's tissues. Hydrogen ion or acidosis is the accumulation of acid and hydrogen ions in the blood and body tissues.
Hyperkalemia
is an abnormally high concentration of potassium ions in the blood. Hypokalemia is low blood potassium. Hypothermia is when the body temperature drops below 35 degrees Celsius. Tension pneumothorax results from an abnormal accumulation of air in the pleural space.
I remember learning this in nursing
school. Cardiac tamponade is a condition caused by the accumulation of fluid between the heart and the pericardium. Toxins may be best uncovered by a focused history. A pulmonary thrombosis or pulmonary embolism is a blood clot from a large vein that breaks off and travels to the pulmonary artery where it becomes lodged. A coronary thrombosis is a blood clot that forms within a blood vessel of the coronary system.
What happens after this?
Shock will arrest rhythm requires CPR and defibrillation.
I just print out my certificate.
So stops the ventricular fibrillation. This is similar to the action of rebooting a computer. It allows the heart's normal rhythm to resume.
And then I bring it to my class tomorrow, which is at 10 a.m. Then you have to do CPR on dummies.
The operation of manual defibrillators requires skill and rhythm analysis. Because when the manual mode is used, there is no computer rhythm analysis or prompting.
The
operator must determine the need for shock delivery and determine the correct shock dose.
The steps for properly performing defibrillation by using a manual defibrillator are the same for performing synchronized cardioversion, with two important exceptions. First, there is no need or indication to hit the sync mode. After the pads are attached, you immediately select the desired energy levels. The second difference between cardioversion and defibrillation is that the energy levels used are higher when defibrillating. For defibrillation, select the appropriate energy dose. For the first defibrillation, choose an energy dose between 2 and 4 joules per kilogram. For the second defibrillation attempt, select an energy dose of 4 joules per kilogram. If additional shocks are needed after the second shock, doses of up to 10 joules per kilogram may be used. A general memory aid is 2, 4, 6, 8. That's the dose to defibrillate.
Wait, what?
Not absolute.
2, 4, 6, 8. That's the dose to defibrillate. I freaking love that. Wait, let's do that again.
A general memory aid is 2, 4, 6, 8. That's the dose to defibrillate.
So cute. That is literally so cute.
Two important exceptions. First, there is no need or indication to hit the sync mode. After the pads are attached, you immediately select the desired energy levels. The second difference between cardioversion and defibrillation is that the energy levels used are higher when defibrillating. For defibrillation, select the appropriate energy dose. For the first defibrillation, choose an energy dose between 2 and 4 joules per kilogram. For the second defibrillation attempt, select an energy dose of 4 joules per kilogram.
If additional shots are needed after the second shot,
doses of up to 10 joules per kilogram may be used. A general memory aid is 2, 4, 6, 8. That's the dose to defibrillate. Again, this is a general
approach. That's going to be like my new motto.
Shots should not exceed the recommended starting or subsequent adult defibrillation dose for that specific defibrillator model. Defibrillation is always done in the context of CPR.
I'm literally going to put that as my quote
for about 2 minutes before rechecking
my Twitter.
Arrhythmias and cardiac arrest states are uncommon in children. The ability to rapidly identify them and immediately intervene can be life-saving. Just as important is preventing cardiac arrest. In children, cardiac arrest states are typically due to the progression of respiratory failure or hypotensive shock states. Accordingly, the ability to rapidly identify these conditions and immediately intervene can be life-saving as well.
Hey, Sue. All right, so we have a kid here. He looks like he's like 8 or something. He's very pale. He has an ET tube inside him right now. Initial assessment. They are like not breathing. Like they're very shallow breathing. Very, very shallow. They just intubated this kid. He has a teddy bear next to him. So cute. Does this patient need immediate intervention? Yes. 100%. Oh, no. Heart rate is 45. Oxygen is 80. Respiratory rate is 6. Blood pressure is 63 over 33. This child is gonna die if we don't do something like now. What's our assessment? They are definitely in sinus brady, and they're kind of in cardiorespiratory failure right now. Oh, look, arrhythmia video case discussion 1. 13-year-old male. Oh, they're 13, not 8. 13-year-old male adolescent with teddy bear. Aww. Cardiorespiratory failure. I was right. What interventions do you anticipate? Provide immediate bag mask ventilation with 100% oxygen. Add chest compressions with ventilation if heart rate does not increase to 60. Provide immediate bag mask ventilation with 100% oxygen. Add chest compressions with ventilation if heart rate does not increase to 40. Nope, that's not right. Provide immediate bag mask ventilation. Yes. Okay, I was correct. The first one was correct. So since he's not breathing on his own, his respiratory rate is 6, you do the bag mask ventilation with 100% oxygen. And if his heart rate doesn't go up from 40 to above 60, then do CPR. Because below 60 is like considered like you need to do chest compressions. Now we have a video of this one kid. He literally just had open heart surgery. You can see the scar. Giant surgical scar down in the middle of his sternum, and he has two. Oh my god, they're on ECMO. Oh,
Okay. Oh, damn. They're straight up in on like actual life support. They're not okay. 15-year-old male adolescent post-heart surgery. Does this patient need immediate intervention? No. He's just chilling. He looks fine. 157 pulse, 95 oxygen, respiratory rate 18, blood pressure 113/74. All right, he's fine. He just had surgery. He's chilling. All right. What is my assessment? He is tachycardic. Wait. Oh, shiz. That is not the heart rhythm I wanted to see. He is literally in VTAC right now. All right, you gotta begin CPR. Wait, but hold up a minute. I mean, where's the shot? We need Denazine. Is it adenosine? Obtain expert consultation? What the hell is that even mean? I don't even know what that means.
Products are shown for demonstration purposes only. The AHA does not endorse or recommend this
product. All over again.
In order to show skills clearly, the healthcare providers in this video do not always use recommended personal protective equipment, such as gloves. To help improve your assessment skills, the American Heart Association training series includes videos of actual children
more.
With medical problems. And of course, at no time was medical care delayed for the purpose of obtaining
more.
This video. All children receive timely and appropriate medical care, and parents provide consent before recording.
All right, post-cardiac arrest care.
Patients display a wide spectrum of responses after successful CPR. After the return of spontaneous circulation, or ROSC, patients may become responsive with adequate spontaneous breathing and good hemodynamic function and systemic perfusion. Other children may remain comatose, apneic, and hemodynamically unstable. Many will require invasive monitoring for optimal management after resuscitation.
After ROSC, your immediate goals are to optimize oxygenation, ventilation, and perfusion, particularly to the brain. That's critical.
As you're addressing these goals, it's important to consider possible contributing factors. With these in mind, let's get back to our immediate goals. First, start with airway and breathing.
You want to make sure the airway is patent and confirm appropriate endotracheal tube placement. End-tidal carbon dioxide or capnography will tell you the tube is in the airway. A chest x-ray is used to evaluate the depth of ET tube insertion and rule out main stem bronchus intubation. When possible, titrate oxygen to maintain pulse oximetry saturation levels between 94 and 99%. Now, this ensures adequate oxygenation without the risk of providing excessive oxygen, which could lead to reperfusion brain injury. Optimize ventilation to maintain carbon dioxide levels appropriate for the patient's specific condition while limiting exposure to severe hypo or hypercapnia. Now, this can be evaluated indirectly by capnography or directly by a blood gas analysis. Obtain a blood gas when possible to correlate with end-tidal carbon dioxide levels. Once you've established a patent airway and optimized oxygenation and ventilation, assess and support the child's hemodynamic function and systemic perfusion by optimizing cardiac output.
Remember, cardiac output is the product of heart rate and stroke volume. Let's talk about heart rate first. Aim for a heart rate that is appropriate for age and clinical condition. Monitor for bradycardia and tachyarrhythmias and treat aggressively if they occur. Bradycardia can occur due to hypoxia, hyperthermia, or cardiac dysfunction. If bradycardia develops, first ensure adequate ventilation and oxygenation. And if bradycardia persists, follow the bradycardia algorithm. Now let's consider stroke volume, which is determined by preload, contractility, and afterload. To increase cardiac preload or the stretch and filling of the ventricles, we administer fluid boluses. Children who've had cardiac arrest often have poor myocardial function and may not tolerate fluid boluses of 20 milliliters per kilogram. That's why you should consider smaller fluid boluses over a longer period of time. To optimize preload in these patients, give 5 to 10 milliliters per kilogram over 10 to 20 minutes. It's also important to reassess the child after each fluid bolus. After you've addressed preload, remember that cardiac contractility may be impaired as well. Assess and correct for hypoglycemia, electrolyte imbalances, and hypocalcemia. If myocardial function remains poor, the use of inotropes such as epinephrine or inodilators such as milrinone may be useful. Hypertension may develop in the post-cardiac arrest period. This may be caused by agitation or seizures. Although hypertension can contribute to increased ventricular afterload and poor cardiac output after ROSC, immediate treatment is really needed. Be sure to avoid hypotension and treat it using fluids, vasopressors, or both. Your goal is to improve perfusion and achieve a systolic blood pressure greater than the 5th percentile for age. Intra-arterial pressure monitoring may be needed to continuously monitor blood pressure and rapidly identify and monitor treatment of hypotension. Neurologic outcome is a fundamental concern after every cardiac arrest. In the immediate post-cardiac arrest setting, you must take the appropriate steps to optimize the child's neurologic outcome. Equally important is preventing secondary brain injury, which may be caused by hypothermia, hypotension, hypoglycemia.
Yeah, a lot of kids just like.
You should also treat conditions that increase the metabolic demand.
Oh
of the
my
brain,
God,
such
this
as hypothermia
one.
Or
oh my
seizures.
God, there's this one baby. It was like this one
for all
like
these children. You should aggressively treat.
16-month-old baby.
Mild hypothermia is common after pediatric cardiac arrest and should not be aggressively treated. For comatose children resuscitated from out of hospital cardiac arrest, providers should maintain either 5 days of normal thermia, defined as 36 to 37.5 degrees Celsius, or 2 days of initial continuous hypothermia, defined as 32 to 34 degrees Celsius. Followed by 3 days of normal thermia.
Seizures may be the result of hypoglycemia, electrolyte imbalances, or the underlying brain injury. Check bedside glucose and rapidly correct hypoglycemia. You'll want to recheck glucose levels routinely to ensure that you're adequately treating hypoglycemia. Finally, when necessary, transport the patient to the most appropriate level of care.
Attention to the details of post-ROS oxygenation, ventilation, perfusion, and neurologic care are important. Addressing all of these factors will help your patient achieve the best possible outcome.
Yeah, there's like this one little baby that like drowned in the bathtub because like mom or whoever was bathing her like stepped away for literally 1 minute and came back and the baby was like unresponsive in the water. And I guess like the time it took for like them to call EMS and get them there and start like CPR and stuff was too long. So the baby now has permanent brain damage and they're literally like a vegetable. They used to be like a happy, healthy, like normal playing baby, and then I was like, I took care of her like sometime last year, I forgot, but she literally is just like no response to anything, just a breathing vegetable essentially. She was so cute though. She's such a cute little baby girl. Parents were so sweet. Okay. Can you optimize ventilation by evaluate? You can optimize ventilation by evaluating which of the following? Capnography and blood gases. Yes. What determines stroke volume? Preload, contractility, and afterload. You can prevent secondary brain injury by correcting which of the following? Hypoglycemia, hypothermia, hypoxia, hypertension. Or is it hypoxia, hypertension, hypothermia, hypotension, hypoglycemia, and hypoxia. There we go. Everything's low, 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 low. Everything is hypo. Hypo, 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 not hyper. All right, lesson number 10, coping with death.
If you have recently experienced the death of a loved one, you may find this video difficult to watch. Please use your discretion in choosing to view the video.
All right, did you hear that disclaimers, y'all? If you have recently experienced the death of a loved one, you may find this video difficult to watch. Please use your discretion in choosing to view the video or listening to whatever I'm going to be playing right now. Please use your discretion.
Please use your discretion in choosing to view the video. In this video, we will discuss how to appropriately care for and communicate with the family of a deceased patient, as well as how to care for yourself and coworkers when you experience the death of a patient. Critical care staff can confront death frequently. In our clinical specialties, we see death that is traumatic, sudden, and unexpected in all ages, from youth to the elderly. Unfortunately, emergency and critical care settings are in stark contrast to the needs of the dying and bereaved. They are fast-paced, focused on life-saving, lack privacy, can be very loud, and tend to have a poor physical layout. The dying and bereaved need time, privacy, and to be a priority. As healthcare providers in these areas, you may have to deliver news of the patient's death to the family. Let's watch a scenario of delivering this news poorly. Afterwards, discuss how the situation could have been handled better.
Hey. I went to see him on my way home, and we were having coffee, and we were talking, and then he just gets this strange look on his face, like he was confused, and just fell down in the kitchen.
I was worried something like this was going to happen to him. You know, he's so stubborn about taking...
about 30 minutes ago.
Has anybody given you an update?
No, sorry. I keep going to that desk over there, and all they tell me is that I have to wait for the doctor if I want any more information.
Oh, I remember this video.
Yes, I'm Sarah. This is my brother, Jimmy.
I remember this.
Can you please tell us what's going on with our dad? She's been asking for half an hour.
I'm sorry, we've been very busy, as you can see, but I'm afraid I have some bad news. Your father didn't make it.
No.
Didn't make it.
No, that's not how
I thought we got here in time for you to help
no,
him.
No,
and his heart stopped.
No,
that's not
no,
possible.
No.
He's 58 years old. This doesn't make any sense.
What do you mean he didn't make
we tried
it?
Everything we could to get his heart started again, but we just couldn't. Sometimes these things happen.
He was fine earlier today.
I understand how you feel. I'm going to get a social worker in here, one of ours, to explain some of
the Maldon!
Get back to some of the patients.
No, don't ever say that! No! He just touched the guy. He was like, stay strong. Your dad just died. No. No, that's not how you do it. No. No.
Wait a second.
Yo.
I want to see my dad.
What an ass. Wow. Can you imagine if the doctor just said that to you after your dad died? Holy crap. Even I'd get pissed. He ain't got time for this. He's like, bye. Stay strong. They're like, can I see my dad? Like, can we see his body? Like, I don't know. All right, here's the right version. I'm actually going to slow it down because it's actually really interesting.
Some family members may become violent upon hearing the news. It's important to keep the family members and your staff safe in such a situation, so don't go alone. Provide information in small amounts. They will only be able to handle bits and pieces at a time. Be sure to use appropriate language to convey your support. Even though we may have the best intentions at heart, our message can come across as insensitive. For example, instead of saying, I understand how you feel, say, I wish it had turned out differently. Rather than saying, it was their time, say, this must be very hard. What can I do for you? If you are the person designated to assist the family, use common language and not medical terminology when explaining efforts to the family. If ever you are responsible for delivering bad news to a family, remember to be clear and accurate and do it in private. You are about to play a role in one of the worst memories of a person's life. Deliver your message the right way, and you have the ability to prevent additional anger and pain from being added to an already tragic situation. It can be helpful to have more than one person deliver the news, for example, a doctor and a nurse. Ideally, family members should have the option of seeing the body. Again, this is an option, and they shouldn't feel pressured or obligated to do so. Many facilities are utilizing things such as a comfort cart to help personalize the sterile environment of the patient rooms. You should speak with your healthcare system and discuss ways that are appropriate to better help families in this traumatic time. Now let's watch two scenarios of better ways to explain the death of a loved one.
Beth, I got her as fast as I could. What's going on? Hold Ricky.
He's in there. I couldn't watch anymore, but the social worker's been keeping me updated.
Well, what happened? What are you doing to him?
I don't know. He was outside playing, and then he came and he said he couldn't breathe. So I called for help, and he seemed fine in the ambulance, and then when they were bringing him in, he was not responding, and he couldn't breathe again, and I don't know what's going on.
Dr. Evans, these are Ricky's parents, Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
Hi. I'm Mary Evans. I'm the doctor who's been caring for Ricky.
And I'm Martha. I've been keeping your wife updated.
How is he, doctor?
I'd like to give you all an update in private, so maybe we can find a room.
Sure. Let's go down here where we can talk.
That's why we have family rooms that have couches and stuff so we can deliver news like this.
So I understand you didn't want to be in the room when Ricky was in trouble. And I know that Martha has been giving you frequent updates, but I have some bad news. Ricky stopped breathing, and shortly after that, his heart stopped. We worked very hard on him, and we did everything we could, but we weren't able to restart his heart. I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but Ricky died a few minutes ago.
I don't understand.
Did he wake up at all? Did he ask for me?
He never did wake up. But I know he wasn't in any pain, and he didn't suffer.
Can we see him?
Of course. I'll go talk to the nurses and make those arrangements. In the meantime, Martha is going to be here for you, and she'll be able to help answer any questions that you have.
What am
I'll talk to you again after you've had a chance to see Ricky. I'm so sorry.
I know you must really be shocked and hurting right now. And I'm here to listen and to answer any questions that you might have. Is there anybody I can call for you? Is there anything I can do for you while we wait?
I don't know.
I can't really think right now.
Yeah. Do you want some privacy or would you like me to stay?
Can you please stay?
Of course. Of course. I'll stay with you as long as you'd like me to.
Thank you.
This is exactly what we say. Yeah.
More and more, it's becoming common practice for the family to be at the bedside to witness a resuscitation. Studies have shown that allowing families to be present can actually help the grieving process. Please stress that family presence during resuscitation is an option. They should not feel pressured or obligated to stay. They should also be able to come and go during the resuscitation as they choose. Have a designated staff member with medical knowledge remain with the family at all times while witnessing efforts. It can be extremely helpful in the grieving process if they have their questions answered about what they have seen.
This is an excellent team. They've been working hard for about an hour, so she should be out soon to talk with you.
The same.
I'm Dr. Mary Evans. I've been caring for Ricky. I know that Martha has been keeping you updated. But unfortunately, I don't have any good news. You can see that we're still doing CPR, but in spite of everything we've done, we haven't been able to restart Ricky's heart. We are going to stop CPR, but I wanted to let you know first.
Wait, what? No.
No. No, stop. You can't stop.
I'm sorry. I know this is very difficult.
I understand.
Hold compressions. Stop CPR.
Oh, God.
I'm so sorry.
Can I see him?
Of course, I'll take him.
Oh. While our focus is always on our patients, and in this case, the family of the deceased, what about us? What about the healthcare professional? We all experience both personal and professional trauma. Every person has a different threshold and range of events that can be conceptualized as traumatic. The negative outcomes from this trauma can be long-lasting. Effects can be physical, psychological, emotional, social, and spiritual. Possible examples are depression and anxiety, avoidance of resuscitation situations, hypervigilance in resuscitation situations, drug and alcohol abuse,
oh God,
the routinization of death,
oh,
lack
yes.
of compassion, and changes in worldview.
Oh yeah.
We truly are the wounded healers.
There's a lot of that in me.
How can we take care of ourselves? In the work setting, the two main avenues are informal and formal debriefs. An informal debrief will take place within a few hours of the actual event. There is usually more involvement in this debrief because it's fresh and everyone involved is present. A formal debrief is usually 48 to 72 hours post-event. It is most helpful to involve all providers who took part in the patient's care, including pre-hospital, ED, and ICU staff. We must develop a strong, positive support system at home and work. Intentionally take time away to decompress and find a way to engage in physical activity. Exercise is extremely helpful in relieving stress and providing an outlet. Finally,
I love
be aware of your stress responses.
Recommend don't be afraid exercise. To reach out for help when you need to. I love how it's like, do exercise to relieve your stress. And I'm like, yeah. Actually, it really does help. That's why I have my Peloton. But I don't ride it as much as I usually do anymore. But anyways, yeah, debriefings are really common, like, when our patient codes, even if they do survive, we usually like debrief after a code and then we do like a informal debriefing. I remember we get emails about that all the time. Now we do them through Zoom though, because of the COCO, but we get like Zoom debriefings. All right. So now this is like the last lesson, I think. Lesson 11. They're going to teach us how to put in a IO, intraosseous access, which means putting in
putting in a line into the bone because you can't find a vein or anything else like that. I've seen this before.
Products are shown for demonstration purposes only. The AHA does not endorse or recommend any specific manufacturer or product. In order to show skills clearly, the healthcare providers in this video do not always use recommended personal protective equipment, such as gloves. To help improve your assessment skills, the American Heart Association training series includes videos of actual children with medical problems. Of course, at no time was medical care delayed for the purpose of obtaining this video. All children received timely and appropriate medical care, and parents provided consent before recording. Intraosseous or IO access can serve as a rapid, safe, and reliable route for the administration of drugs and fluids when peripheral venous access cannot be rapidly achieved. The IO route provides access to a non-collapsible venous plexus, which is especially useful during resuscitation. This serves as an acceptable alternative to the IV route for any PALS medication that can be given by the IV route, including vasoactive drugs. IO access also provides an alternative route for the administration of crystalloids and colloids. Many sites are appropriate for IO infusion. See your device-specific instructions for a list of approved sites. For children, the most common site is the proximal tibia. In order to access this site, position the leg with slight external rotation. Identify the tibial tuberosity just below the knee joint. The insertion site is the flat part of the tibia about one finger width, or 1 to 3 centimeters, below and medial to this bony prominence, so as to avoid injuring the growth plate. Stabilize the leg on a firm surface to facilitate needle insertion. Do not place your hand behind the leg. The stylet should remain in place during insertion to prevent the needle from becoming clogged with bone or tissue. Insert the needle so that it is perpendicular to the tibia. There will be a sudden lack of resistance when the needle is placed correctly, and the needle should stand easily without support. Remove the stylet and attach an empty syringe to confirm appropriate placement. Aspiration of the syringe may reveal pink-tinged fluid or blood in the hub of the needle, but if no fluid returns, it does not necessarily mean that the IO needle is incorrectly placed. Attach a saline-filled syringe and infuse a small volume while observing for swelling at the insertion site, and posteriorly in case the needle has penetrated the other side of the bone. Fluid should easily infuse with saline injection from the syringe. The distal tibia, just above the medial malleolus, the anterior aspect of the distal femur, just above the knee, and the anterior superior iliac spine are other sites that can be used for IO access. After the IO needle is properly inserted into the bone and appropriately secured, drugs and fluids flow through the bone marrow cavity into the circulation, though depending on location, they may first pass through peripheral circulation. As is routine practice when providing most IV drugs, all IO medications are followed with a flush up to 10 milliliters, depending upon the size of the child. Keep in mind that even after successful insertion of the catheter into the bone marrow, there's often resistance to infusion, which a provider may mistakenly interpret as incorrect placement. Bolus administration or the use of an infusion pump may be useful in overcoming the resistance. Healthcare providers should keep in mind that certain contraindications exist. Contraindications to IO access include fractures and crush injuries near the access site, conditions with fragile bones, such as osteogenesis imperfecta, and previous attempts to establish access in the same bone. If infection is present in the overlying tissues, IO cannulation should be avoided. After IO cannulation, providers should check the site frequently for signs of swelling and needle displacement. Remember that fluids or drugs delivered via a displaced needle can cause severe complications, such as tissue necrosis or compartment syndrome. IO needles are intended for short-term use, generally less than 24 hours. Replacement with long-term vascular access is usually accomplished in an intensive care setting.
IOs are painful. Holy crap, I remember they try to put two IOs in this baby. And actually that same, you know, Bulbasaur, the little Bulbasaur baby that I was talking about the other day. So Bulbasaur, in her last admission, was like severely hypoglycemic and hypothermic, and she's like a really hard stick, so they couldn't get a line in her. So they try to put two IOs in her. One was unsuccessful, and then they got another one in. But then the IO that they put in was, it was working, but it was causing like extreme pain, and you could tell because she was like screaming. So they ended up just putting in they asked vascular to come, and they found an IV, but like, you know, one IV blue. Yeah, this is a lot. We actually have like an IO, the IO kit in our crash cart. It's literally like a little drill. It's like a tiny, tiny drill that's connected to like a catheter. So essentially you're just drilling the catheter inside to their bone. Yeah. All right. Which of the following is an appropriate intraosseous site? Posterior superior iliac, but nope. Proximal tibia? Nope. It's a distal tibia. I wasn't even listening. I don't know anything. I'm not going to be putting in an IO. Which of the following is contraindications to IO access? Fracture near access site. Yes. Congratulations! You have completed the pre-course work for PALS. Your next step is attending the PALS instructor-led course.
Please select exit exercise at the top of the window. After exiting the pre-course work, print the certificate. Holy crap, I'm finally done. I want to sleep. Rune is asking, is it like a port? No, it's literally like an IV, but in your bone, because your bone has veins in it. I mean, it has blood circulation in there. Okay, so what do I need to do? I need to do a stupid survey. All right, let's do this survey. I'll just click whatever. Oh, good. Yes, yes, yes. I'm confident. Yes. Yes. I took this course. Yes. Blah, blah, blah. Have you? Blah, blah, blah. Optional questions. Not going to do them. Submit. What? Content was presented clearly. Yes. Okay, done. Done. All right. Download completion certification. I will now print this out and bring it to my class tomorrow. You looked up an IO? Yeah, IOs are fancy. Fancy schmancy. Okay. So I'm going to nap. Wait, what was I going to do today? I had a whole to-do list. Okay, I was gonna do my, okay, wait. First thing was to declog my drain, which kind of happened, but Mama Nightingale said she will declog my drain later tonight. I was gonna do some shopping on Amazon, but I can do it later. I need a new toothbrush. I can get that later. I have a lot of stuff to record, so I think I might do that before Pancake. And then I need to set up pancakes for later. The colors and stuff. I cleaned my room. I need to choose some songs for tomorrow's karaoke. Okay, I did the PALS pre-coursework, so that's done. All right. That's it. Those are all the things that I need to do today. I know a lot of chores and naps to do, and maybe I need to eat lunch because I haven't had any lunch, and it's already 5 p.m. I only have 4 hours to do whatever the hell I need to do. So what do I prioritize? Okay, I'm going to ride the Peloton for like 30 minutes to an hour, and I'll maybe record something, and then that'll give me some time to... Okay, so I have 4 hours. 1 hour, 1 hour nap. 1 hour eat nap. Then it'll be six. At 6 o'clock, I ride the Peloton for 30 minutes. Record some things until like 7:30 or 8. Make my pancake batter at 8. And then start stream at 9. Or I can push it back to 9:30. I don't know. This is just how I think. Okay. Eat while riding the Peloton. No. Thank you guys for coming. All of you. I'll give shout outs. And thank you, Xander. I'm so sorry. No. Thank you. Plus, plus, plus. Wait, Xander, why are you here? Wait. Why are you here? Thank you, Floria. Thank you, Saka. Saka Tagintoki. Thank you, Just Togibi. Thank you, Runa77. Thank you, Milky. Thank you, Lobit Art. Thank you, Fez. Thank you, Boomer Owl. Thank you, Chad Doc Squirrel. Thank you, Joho. Thank you, Veranas. Thank you, Kay. Thank you, Smiley Face Cat Face Person.
I didn't even notice that you were here, Xander. That's actually so funny. Anyways, hope you enjoyed. Lots of fun stories to come in the future. I will let you know how my pals course goes tomorrow. Gonna be so fun with all those scenarios. My favorite scenario, the baby choking on the barbecue. I'm pretty sure they're gonna make us do that. All right, I'm gonna go take my nap now. I hope you guys have a
what do I say?
I'm streaming later at 9 p.m. Eastern time. And pancakes, I think. Tomorrow I have my pals, and then I come home, and then I have some appointments, and then I have to do the karaoke guitar stream tomorrow, and then Project Winter collab with the Loaders. Yeah, big hype. And then I don't know what happened. And then I go to work and die again. Okay, bye bye. Thank you for listening. Busy, so that's you. Okay, guys, now I'll soon me. This is the third of the Nightingale signing off Twitter space. Over an owl hoot, I'll soon me.